and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The pro-war party backing the Ukraine project is losing ground. The Kiev regime and its European supporters have backed themselves into a corner. They can't win, they refuse to negotiate, and they can't afford the status quo. Is the solution the Budapest summit? Maybe. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Rossi, in New York. He is a lecturer of political science at Rutgers University. In Virginia, we have James Jatras. He is a former U.S. diplomat and former advisor to U.S. Senate Republican leadership. And we also have Benoit Paré. He is a former international monitor in Ukraine with the OSCE, as well as author of the book, What I Saw in Ukraine. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, I'll go to you first in New York. I'm calling this program the War Party Outmaneuvered. Is that a premature statement, considering the man in the White House?
The thing with President Trump, and I've come to accept this, is that his mood changes by the week. One week, he's in Russia's camp telling Ukraine, cut a deal, otherwise you'll be destroyed. The next week, he is making insinuations to Russia that they better cut a deal with Ukraine, otherwise the United States will get involved. I'm not exactly sure what the strategy is, except to keep everyone else guessing and make everybody as dependent on Trump's attitude of that day and cut a deal when the window of opportunity happens to be in their favor.
Yeah, and we'll get back to maybe that window is Budapest, but we're going to hold that for the second part of the program. James, one of the things that, you know, we discussed on this program was the Anchorage summit, and I did not have much expectation for it, and my expectations were met. We can't, you know, you can't step into the same river twice. We can't have a repeat of this. Your thoughts?
Well, what's the expression that history never repeats itself, but it rhymes? I don't think we can discount that Budapest will turn out to be Anchorage 2.0. Let's keep in mind two things. One is the most important thing for Trump is appearances. He wants to appear the winner. He wants to have solved this 88th war, just like the Gaza deal that's not really much of a deal. That's the most important thing for him. The second thing is, and I think we never should lose sight of this, there is no deal on Ukraine that the West can be trusted to honor, that whatever kind of proposal that Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump appear to agree on, and this is the trap for the Russians, they will be taking a what amounts to a Minsk 3.0 and putting lipstick on the pig and hope that the Russians will buy it. But whatever the deal is, the West will not keep its side of the bargain, and I think the Russians need to understand that.
Benoit, you were nodding your head in agreement with Jim. You were in Ukraine, one of the monitors with the OSCE, which an organization that acquitted itself quite badly, and your book is a testament to that. The problem I have with all of this talk about a ceasefire, security guarantees for Ukraine. The problem I have, Benoit, with all of this is that there isn't a big picture view here. What about security for all? Security guarantees for all. And this is what the OSCE was supposed to be about. It failed, and I don't think it's a vehicle that we can be used in the future. But once you, I describe it as having a 30,000 feet view. What is everybody, what do all the parties want? One thing they all want security. Why don't we work from that point and then work down? Go ahead, Benoit.
Well, as you suggest, actually, the problem, the main problem is that the West, the entire West, actually neglected completely the security concerns that Russia had. And they've done so for the last decades. So that's the main issue here. The West, now it's Europe, still doesn't want to consider any security concerns, even valid security concerns that Russia could have. And that's the main issue behind everything. There's no will to see that side of things. They keep talking about security guarantees for Ukraine, but then are never willing to listen to Russia's concern. And by talking to Russian career diplomat in one of our previous missions, I remember it was in the OSCE mission in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It was long ago, in 1999, during the time when NATO was bombing Serbia. And we were there based in Tuzla, 30 kilometers away from the border. And he told me one day, the problem with the West is that you have kept trying to destroy the Orthodox culture for 1,000 years. That was his belief. So, and then he started to talk about, you know, the schism, and then the Crusades, and then Napoleon, and then Hitler. And he said, and now it's NATO, you know, that you've constantly tried to destroy us as a civilization.
Yep.
This is how they think, right? And the problem is that we have not, in recent years, given them any reassurances that we would think otherwise. It was rather the opposite when you listen to Kaja Kallas, who says that her dream is to see Russia dismantled into small states.
The good thing is almost no one takes her seriously, but she is a good reflection of EU foreign policy. Michael, again, staying with security, if Russia is denied its rightful security needs, then Europe will never be safe, and vice versa. This is not that hard, Michael.
You know, I always find it interesting that the biggest war hawks now are coming from those that want peace in Ukraine in the European Union. We're talking about people that I'm not exactly sure what they're seeing, but they're still very confident that Russia is not going to win, okay, that Ukraine will have its 1991 borders restored. I really would just like to know what it is that makes them believe this, because, I mean, it's just self-inflicted gaslighting. We talk about security. Yes, absolutely. Russia's security has never been taken seriously by Europe. Europe is ratcheting up the war rhetoric that eventually there will be war in Europe, that Ukraine is just the opening stages. And, you know, after Ukraine, the Baltics come next, then Poland, then Romania, then Germany, then, you know, what, the Pyrenees. I mean, you know, and at the same time, Russia can't win in Ukraine, but yet we need to gear up for war that Russia will obviously wage across the entire European continent. Pick your stereotype.
Yeah, well, okay, and
stick
Mike,
with it.
And Michael, you probably remember as well as I do. Remember, Ronald Reagan was angry that the Europeans were buying Soviet energy, and so now now you can't buy it. Okay, well that's water off the of a duck for Russia. Fine, we'll sell it to somebody else. I mean, you're punishing yourselves. You're not punishing the supplier. It doesn't make any sense. James, the topic of Tomahawks, the next wonder weapon, was all over the place for about, what, 10 days now? That seems to be off the table. I would posit it to you, it had nothing to do with the Tomahawks. It was getting Trump to escalate. That's what the Ukraine's backers want. They want Trump to escalate. It has really nothing to do with the Tomahawks itself. James.
That's right. And of course, that's the problem with Trump. I mean, a lot of people are saying, oh, thank goodness, you know, the Tomahawks are off the table. He's decided not to send them. And maybe because we don't have as many of them as we like to think we have. But who knows, you know, a day or 2 days or a week, whatever it is, he could change his mind again. Or there'll be some other flavor of the month, Wunderwaffe, that's going to change the war. Meanwhile, I think a lot of people are misreading the Europeans, this, Zelensky, that, Trump is, you know, look, I think a lot of this division is less serious than it appears, that the Trump administration has been very, very clear. They want to shift the burden of this whole Ukraine mess onto the Europeans. Bleed the Europeans white as Ukraine has been bled white. And this is a little bit of a dog and pony show. They want time to build up a military machine of NATO to prepare for war or with Russia in the not too distant future. And the real question is whether the Russians will give them that time.
You know, Benoit, it's really interesting if you look at the mainstream legacy media. The whole conversation, the whole narrative of what's going on, it looks like it's the Americans and the Russians on one side and the Ukrainians and the Europeans on the other side. Your thoughts?
Well, what's interesting is that there seemed to have been a shift of the balance of power within the West since Trump was reelected. Because it seems that the globalist deep state now, it cannot really control American policy as it used to. So, but now it controls, it seems it controls completely the European bloc. So now it is the European bloc that is the most, the biggest warmonger on the international scene, as far as Ukraine is concerned. And you have this unanimity among all of the European leaders. They are ready actually to go against their own economic interest. They are ready to cut all economic ties with Russia, not by Russian oil, not by Russian gas, because, you know, it's bad. So they prefer to pay four times the price and buy American oil or gas, or buy the same Russian gas from India twice the price. Whatever, it's absurd, but it doesn't matter. They keep going as if, the interest of the Europeans is the last of their priorities. All matters is to obey to the globalist deep states that tells them you need to cut all ties with Russia. And the media machine that is under their control just repeats this message over and over. And we are now in the demonization process of Russia day and night. And now we are told that, you know, Europe needs to be ready to actually wage war against Russia within the next 5 years. This is insane. So we are inventing the idea, as you mentioned earlier, that Russia, after Ukraine, will try to invade, you know, the rest of Europe. When they are, at the same time, we are told, oh, look, Russia is so weak. They only managed to conquer 1% of the Ukrainian territory over the last year, right? But the same Russia that cannot control, that cannot conquer more than 1% of the Ukrainian territory per year, will actually want to control the whole of Europe within the next few years.
I phrased this many, many years ago. It's either 007 or Keystone Cops. You have to choose. They can't be both at the same time. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Michael. Michael, I think one of the meta themes here, looking at Trump's approach to this conflict, is that ultimately he wants to he wants all the acolytes to praise him for winning the peace, however that is defined. But most importantly, he doesn't want to be blamed for, quote unquote, losing Ukraine. That's what he's concerned. He's concerned with his legacy, with his prestige. He isn't really particularly interested in the fate of Ukraine. I would say that I think he has always wanted to have better relations with Russia. So, you know, even in his calculation, Ukraine is not that important. And I think the more the Europeans kick up the dust the way they do, he resents that very, very much. So, as I said, you know, to Benoit in the first part of the program, it looks like it's the U.S. and Russia on one side, the Europeans and the Ukrainians on the other. And all of this, all of you have mentioned here, you know, war by 2030. Well, Michael, if we got a five-year window, maybe negotiations, maybe try diplomacy. I mean, if we got a five-year window, can someone explain to me why that's not even a remote possibility in the minds of the war party?
I mean, this is a question that we can spend an entire segment on. So I'll try to truncate this as much as possible here. The way that I see this, and I'm looking big picture because Trump does seem to be unpredictable week by week. But it seems to me that Trump recognizes the realities of a multipolar world, whether he won't admit it, but he recognizes the importance of maintaining more important relations with countries like Russia, China, and India. Europe is small potatoes. And Europe, at the end of the day, can talk about ratcheting up, war rhetoric and preparing for a war with Russia. History has shown us in the last 30 years, we talked about the NATO bombardment of Yugoslavia, the dismemberment of Yugoslavia. If we know anything about the United States and telling Europe, things in your continent are your responsibility, you handle it. Guess what they don't do? They don't handle it. They can't handle it. Mm-hmm. Kosovo is a great example of this right now, where it is run by a rabid nationalist who is openly doing everything he can to demobilize the Serbian minority. What is Europe doing? Nothing. They're still blaming Serbia for the being the main destabilizers within the region. If Trump hands Ukraine over to the Europeans, this is a blessing in disguise for Russia, because Putin knows that Europe is going to wither and dither. There is no main, you know, effort to mobilize for war with Russia. And Trump, if nothing else, he doesn't want to antagonize relations with Russia. He wants to end the war in Ukraine. But if nothing else, he wants to wash his hands of it and say to everybody, I did everything that I could.
Yep.
I'm up against obstacles that I just can't deal with. I tried. Remember, it seems like forever, but Trump is still in year one of his second term. Yeah. He's going to be around for another 3 years.
Yes, that's a lot of material for me and this program. James, again, I think I agree very much with what Michael's saying. I mean, it's more Trump knows that the Ukrainians are not going to win. He knows the Europeans can't do it over the long haul. It's a huge grift. It should be familiar to anyone that watched the 20-year war in Afghanistan, one huge grift. And the grift will keep it going. But Trump has other things on his mind. And I think he has a very 19th century geopolitical outlook. After all, the first days of his administration, he talked about McKinley, the great colonizer and imperialist. So Trump wants to wash his hands of this, but he doesn't want to be blamed for it. Jim.
Well, I think that's right. But let me sound a little bit of a dissenting note, because I don't really think there's that much difference between Trump and the Europeans. I think it's more of a good cop, bad cop kind of thing. To the extent to which Trump really wants to improve relations with Moscow, where's the evidence? I mean, where's he taking the Russians up on their proposal to get arms control talks going again? Why hasn't he reopened the consulates? Why are we not even back to the level of relations we had between, say, Nixon and Brezhnev? I mean, we don't even have that. I think Trump, again, wants the appearance of having to walk away, but just dump the whole burden on the Europeans, but still keep up this confrontation with Russia. And I don't see any evidence that he really wants to change that fundamentally. I think it's like you said, it's a grift, and that's really all he has as his stock in trade.
You know, Benoit, how could give me your scenario, what a Budapest summit will look like, okay? What needs to happen? And we don't need a repeat of Anchorage. Anchorage was a starter, you know, get to know each other, break the ice, as it were, in Anchorage. But what needs to happen to be meaningful in Budapest? And we don't even know the date yet.
Well, if you see things from the Russian perspective, of course, you can expect them to, Trump to, they would hope that Trump would finally agree with their view of the issue, the problem they have with Ukraine. I mean, perfectly know since, you know, the first day of the special military operation, what are the objectives of the Russian state, right? Which is demilitarization of Ukraine, denazification, recognition that Crimea is part of Russia, and then it was a recognition of independence of the this independent republics of the Donbas, but now they're actually fully integrated into the Russian state. So now they raise the bar higher, right? Now they want the West, and at least America, to recognize that all these four oblasts that they have conquered are now fully part of the Russian territory. They want the West, at least Trump, to acknowledge that. If they managed to acknowledge all these things too from the Trump administration, they would have made a major step from this point of view. Now, the thing is, there are many people, I believe, around Trump, maybe not, I'm not sure if he himself has a clear idea of what he wants, but probably many people around him who are like remains of a deep state have shown so far that they do not want Russia to fulfill its goals in Ukraine. Right, because the American deep state for the last 30 years at least has tried to weaken Russia, not to strengthen it, and so they see any outcome of this war that could be considered as a victory for Russia as a failure for the West, the global West.
Yeah, but
people say that
But that's a fascinating way of describing mm-hmm. it. Let me go to Michael here, because when you phrase it that way, it's self-defeating, because it's going to happen, okay? If you can rephrase it as I've been saying all along, is that we need to step back and look at the entire pan-European security architecture. And then winners and losers become less important. And this is a trap, because if Ukraine fails, NATO fails. Well, I would like that. NATO should be dissolved. But this is not how the policymakers. But when you do it that, if Ukraine fails, NATO fails, by saying that, it will happen. You need to rephrase it when it comes to outside of NATO, because NATO is the problem here. When you take it outside of the NATO context, it begins a little bit easier to negotiate. I think that's a more pragmatic approach. Michael.
We've talked about this before on the show, ideological rigidity of liberalism, international relations liberalism, right? Yeah. The understanding that there is a moral ethos that the West has that is superior to that of the rest. And so this understanding, if Ukraine falls, NATO falls, this is a warning. This is basically this idea that all stakes are on the defense of Ukraine. They have to believe that Russia will fail. They have to believe that if they continue to defend Ukraine, it might not roll the Russian forces back, but it will eventually attrition the country. It will weaken the country. And that the European resolve at the end, even if it's a Pyrrhic victory, they will say, we won and NATO is still here. This is the whole problem. Ideological rigidity is the one major obstacle towards a lasting peace that works for everyone. Russia, Ukraine, Europe, and the rest of the world.
Yeah, but Jim, the word attrition has been mentioned here. I don't think the Europeans are doing too well in that category here, okay? Particularly when it comes to deindustrialization, energy prices, et cetera, et cetera. And plus their censorship regime, banning politicians, banning parties, rigging elections. I mean, the attrition, if it's the attrition equation, the Europeans ain't doing so good, Jim.
That's right. Well, look, Trump did not become president to preside over the dissolution of the global American empire. These non-entities that lead the European countries, that are leading their countries to ruin, will still keep doing what daddy says. And even if Trump wanted to go to Budapest and come up with something that approximated the Russian concerns, I don't think he's capable of delivering on that. The best he can hope for is some kind of a memorandum of intent with the Russians that would point or at least approximate the Russian concerns, but can't really deliver on them. Meanwhile, the escalation is going to continue one way or the other because the Europeans are committed to that. And frankly, Washington, not just Trump personally, whatever he thinks personally doesn't really matter much, but the deep state, the neocons he's surrounded with, want to build up a European force to prepare for war with Russia in the next few years. I don't think that's going to change.
I tend to agree. Michael, we have 1 minute more. James mentioned the Europeans. I would correct, I'd say the European elites, because this is an elite project. Michael.
Yes. Sentiment within Europe among ordinary people are already beginning, if they haven't already been doing so for years, asking why? Why is this so important? Why is this a matter of life and death? Plus, the very same people that are condemning what is going on in Russia are turning blind eye and deaf ear to what's happening in Palestine.
And also, to back up what James had to say, Trump's policy vis-a-vis Venezuela, it shows the continuation of an imperial impulse, okay? And I know what the reaction will be. Well, the Western Hemisphere is none of your business, America's okay. But, you know, that doesn't cut the dice when it comes to international law. So, gentlemen, we discussed a lot, we covered a lot, but we didn't resolve much, but that's the state of affairs of the world right now. I want to thank all three of my guests. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.